Hello, everybody. John Robson here from the Climate Discussion Nexus, welcoming you all to our webinar with Dr. Judith Curry. Dr. Curry, as I think most of you know, is Professor Emeritus and a former chair of the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the Georgia Institute of Technology, and now the principal at the Climate Forecast Applications Network. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, John, and thank you, everyone, for tuning in.
And you are also the author of this new book, well, fairly new, Climate Uncertainty and Risk, Rethinking Our Response, published in 2023. So I wanted to begin by asking, what's the main message of the book and why is it so important now?
Okay, well, the main message of my book is that the United Nations and all of the people, you know, pushing the mainstream narrative, they have way oversimplified both the problem and the response. This is an exceedingly complex issue with the slow creep of global warming confounded by natural climate variability. It's not obvious to what extent warming is actually dangerous, and different people have different opinions about that, and different regions are impacted in different ways. And there's deep uncertainty regarding our understanding as to how the climate might play out for the rest of the 21st century. So my book grapples with all this and provides a different way of framing the problem, so that we can make more robust decisions and increase our resilience to whatever might come our way in terms of climate variability and change.
And I think one of the very interesting things about your presence in the debate is that you had a long and successful academic career in which I don't think you had much of a reputation as someone who's looking for trouble, but then trouble came and found you, and you have been the target of some very unkind remarks from people like Michael Mann or the D-Smog blog. And at the same time, you published this very important paper back in 2010 on rebuilding trust in science. And Tony Watt said that he almost wasn't sure he should publish it, given that you used words like denier. So how did you find yourself in the crossfire, particularly for taking what on the whole looked like some of the more reasonable positions out there?
Okay, well, I started participating in the climate blogosphere, I think in 2006. And I checked out both what I would say the warmest blogs and then the more skeptical blogs. And I, you know, was commenting and things like that. And I really got engaged by the climate audit blog by, you know, which is Steve McIntyre's blog, the arch enemy of Michael Mann. And they were asking some really good questions. They wanted to see the data and so forth and so on. And I even published some guest posts there. Now, the people on the alarm side thought this was great fun, you know, that I was, you know, giving the skeptics grief and going on their territory to grapple with them. The turning point was really in November of 2009 with ClimateGate. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but this was the release, unauthorized release of the emails from the University of East Anglia. So, I mean, I was on the ground floor. I was interacting with all the skeptics' blogs where these emails were released to. And I was, you know, talking with Steve McIntyre, you know, in the early days. And we decided that I should, you know, try to calm the waters, you know, in the skeptics community, so this didn't become all out, you know, nuclear warfare. So I wrote a series of several essays that were originally posted on Climate Audit, and these went viral, picked up by the mainstream media, including the New York Times. And so, and I was, you know, spouting common sense things, you know, saying that scientists need to be more transparent, make their data publicly available, and need to be honest about uncertainties and what we don't know. And finally, that they need to be respectful of people who disagree with them. Now, I thought these were, you know, motherhood and apple pie statements, but the climate establishment, you know, very quickly identified me as the Antichrist, if you will, you know, for challenging the consensus and criticizing the important people, and on and go. And I became, you know, a chief enemy. And after about a year of not knowing how to deal with me, they thought, oh, I know how we can deal with her. Let's just start labeling her as a denier, you know, and toss her over into the other camp with cranks and the oil companies and whatever. And so the alarmist media picked up on this right away. And very quickly, if you Googled my name, you know, the first 20 hits would be Judith Curry, serial climate disinformer, Judith Curry, climate denier. And that pretty much, you know, destroyed my academic reputation, because, you know, who wants to hire somebody with a, you know, a Google profile, you know, social media profile that where everybody's calling her a denier. So, you know, I resigned my faculty position in 2017 and went into the private sector, which is a much friendlier place for me to be, where I can speak out and do the kind of analyses that I think are right. I don't have to worry about important people criticizing me and ruining any kind of reputation. I mean, I'm out there trying to preserve, you know, the integrity of scientific research and opening up the debate, both the scientific debate and the policy debate, you know, to a broad range of perspectives, so we can try to get a better handle on this situation and do things that are sensible, not stupid.
It's a little hard to believe that could be controversial, but in fact, I think there are a couple of cautionary tales there. One of them being, of course, that this happened to you toward the end of your career, where you were in a position to walk away from it. If someone were in their early 30s, let us say, and hoping for tenure, and witnessed you're getting railroaded in this way, it would certainly tell them that unless they had some compelling plan B, they'd better keep their mouths shut, including not just about, you know, some of the more pointed questions one might ask about the extreme alarmist position. But, and this to me is the most remarkable part, over saying things like science should be more open, data should be available, things that, again, yes, you'd think this couldn't be controversial. Nobody could disagree with that. And again, Steve McIntyre has these stories about trying to get tree ring data sets just to see, because Steve's a very mathematical guy, and to see what, if he worked on them, he'd get the same results, and getting stonewalled, that this seems like an odd way to do science. And again, some of us arguably have been kind of looking for trouble since we were quite young. I don't think that you fit that profile, but it was this, I defending what used to be absolutely conventional wisdom about how to do science rather than what the science was actually telling us, that landed you in this enormously hot water. And I guess Michael Mann labeled you a delayer, which is where you're one of these people who's so cunning and sinister that rather than saying things that will immediately be demolished by the consensus, you were just trying to drag things out, which is an attack on your motives for asking people to do science the right way.
Well, delayer is probably the most complimentary name that Michael Mann has ever called me. But okay, in 2010, you know, I had the thought, and I thought, you know, this could really go south for me, you know, on a time scale of 3 to 5 years, you know, my tenure in academia, you know, maybe just become intolerable. I thought, well, I can sort of afford to do this. My mortgage is paid off. My daughter is, I've already put her through college, and I had already started the private sector company a few years before. And I said, well, you know, I do have a plan B if this goes south. And by 2013, it was clear that it had really gone south. And so I hung on for, you know, a little bit more, just, you know, to solidify my finances and, you know, cut a deal with Georgia Tech to, you know, retire on a certain timeline and, you know, they supported it, and then off I went. Goodbye. So, you know, I'm in a very good place right now. You know, I walked away from a very big salary, retired prematurely, but my life is much happier and much saner, and I'm in a position to have a greater impact on helping people, companies, governments, government agencies better understand and manage their weather and climate related risk. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Well, they do say that the best revenge is living well. The people who drove you out of academia, and you've become considerably more prominent in the debate since, I think, may well regret what they did. Now, it's interesting. I was looking at your publications, and in addition to this latest one, there's a book here. I just want to make sure I get the title right. Thermodynamics of Atmospheres and Oceans, which obviously is a real page-turner for the layperson. But the title in itself speaks to the fact that the science around climate is extremely complex. And I would say one of the things, my own background, I mean, I'm a journalist, I have a doctorate in history. And when the climate alarmist business really got going in the late 90s, one of the red flags for me was that they were saying things that didn't seem to me to fit what I knew about the history of climate. But another one was that they were arguing in ways that I didn't like. They seemed familiar and not in a good way. And one of these is they keep saying the science is settled, the physics is simple. And then you look at oceans and ocean currents and so on. This stuff is mind-bogglingly complicated. And that's one of the reasons that it's quite uncertain.
Oh, absolutely. And the sun and surprises from volcanic eruptions. And there's all sorts of climate surprises that natural climate variability has produced over the last 4.6 billion years. And, you know, these surprises are ongoing. The most recent big surprise being the Hunga Tonga eruption. That was totally, you know, unanticipated and is having some. This is an exceedingly complex issue. And our understanding of all this is really in its infancy. And we need to acknowledge that. And, you know, there's so many exciting frontiers that we need to be challenging, exploring, et cetera. And the important people, if you will, and the advocates and the IPCC have put this very simple frame around the whole thing and are trying to enforce that. And, you know, people who understand the complexity of both the science and the policymaking surrounding an issue like this, a wicked problem, as I've characterized it in my book, you know, just have a completely different perspective on this, which is a much more realistic and pragmatic perspective. And the route that we're on right now, I mean, with, you know, net zero and all that, it just stands to make, you know, all of our problems worse and not change the climate one iota. So, you know, we need to rethink this whole thing. And this is what my book tries to do. It reframes the whole thing and tries to make us think more broadly about the problem and its solutions.
Yeah, and what I mean, I of course get into discussions. At least we try to have discussions. Sometimes that's not quite the right word. And when people comment on our videos and so on, including from Arctic ice, what do we deduce from the fact that there was a considerable diminution in Arctic ice from 1979 until around 2006, and since then it's leveled off? And a lot of people are saying, well, we just know this proves we're melting the ice and we're overheating the planet and terrible things are happening. And my response isn't, oh, fooey, we know nothing is happening. My response is, these are complicated phenomena. You can't easily fit a curve to these data points. We're more and more uncertain about the data going further back. And we were recently commented on something Roger Pilkey Jr. said, that when you're looking for trends and phenomena that fluctuate naturally, you may need to wait hundreds of years to understand whether you're seeing a trend or not, even if, and this is a critical point, even if you don't have hundreds of years, you need to know now, but you can't. Life is full of things you need to know that you don't know. I mean, I think of Dwight Eisenhower on the eve of D-Day writing two speeches, one announcing that it had succeeded, one announcing that it had failed. He didn't know if it was going to work. And you'd think when you say go, you've got to know if it's going to work, but he couldn't and he didn't. And so one of the things, and again, you may get caught in the crossfire here, but we'll try and fend off the more hostile comments. How much, how certain are you that humans are warming the planet?
Well, they're warming it to some extent. I mean, how much, we don't know. I mean, we know, you know, the basic mechanism where you emit carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and CO2 has an infrared emission spectra, which overall acts to warm the planet. But how much, you know, is the big question. And, you know, we don't know. So chapter 12 in my book is actually entitled Decision Making Under Deep Uncertainty. Okay, what do you do, you know, like Eisenhower's problem, when you don't really know? And the challenge is to make robust decisions that make some sort of sense, no matter how it turns out, you know, how the situation plays out. And the other one is just to reduce your vulnerabilities to surprises in general. I mean, these are the kind of strategies that you should adopt when you have deep uncertainty like this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, and that's one of the points. I mean, among the other fields in which I have trained and worked is economics. And so I have a certain amount of confidence about what economic policies are likely to work and which ones aren't. And getting rid of the energy that drives our economy and sustains our lifestyle and feeds so many people so much better than humanity has ever seen before, that's going to cause a disaster. That one isn't that hard to suss out. But then you look on the other side, and I'm going to, my historical take on this, you say, well, humans are warming the planet to some degree, but how much? Well, we've seen, you know, an increase in temperature maybe of a degree and a half since, they call it pre-industrial times, which is silly because they mean 1850, right? Everything back to the creation of the Earth is pre-industrial. But there would have been a natural rebound anyway. We're coming out of the Little Ice Age. Some of it must be natural. There's not a lot left for humans to have caused. What would you give up to make it 0.3 degrees cooler? And how sure can anyone be that if we did somehow get the planet down by 0.3 degrees Celsius, that it would improve anything, including the weather?
Well, okay, even if we stopped emissions right now, and we waited 50 years, and climate models have even run this experiment with a full carbon cycle, some models keep warming and some models show a little bit of cooling. But the point is, you can't easily unring this bell. There's very long time scales in the oceans and in the ice sheets. And in fact, in the deep Pacific Ocean, it's still cooling. It's responding to the Little Ice Age. You know, there are, you know, all sorts of different time scales in the Earth system that, you know, you can't unring this bell. And in terms of extreme weather events, there's little evidence, apart from heat waves, that warming actually makes any of these worse. So, and we're not going to slow the slow creep of sea level rise. I mean, that's locked, you know, what's going on right now is, you know, locked something in probably for several centuries. And this is, you know, the melting of ice sheets and Greenland and glaciers. I mean, that started big time in the 1920s, you know, before fossil fuel emissions were very heavy. So, you know, it's not like we're going to improve things, and certainly not on the time scale of the 21st century, by following the net zero type policies. So it's sort of putting, you know, like putting on a hair shirt, you know, with no objective at all that would help us help improve our situation either now or over the course of the 21st century.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I've cited a number of times, I had the chance to go, I've been on one cruise ship in my whole life, went up to Alaska's Glacier Bay, and they gave us this very nice pamphlet showing, oh yeah, the glaciers are melting, and it's, you know, they said it was us. But the map actually went back into the very late 17th century when the glaciers were right out in the Pacific. And then you see them going, shooting up the fjords. They've gone most of the way up by the 1890s. And I look at this and say, surely you're seeing a long natural phenomenon here. And also because they had this thing about the wonderful Aboriginal lifestyle that people had there 500 or 600 years ago in these sort of alluvial plains. And then the glaciers came and just scraped them all out. And when they went away, they were left with rocks and water. And, you know, they found ways to adapt. But this showed a very dramatic natural piece of climate change. And the strong suggestion, again, you say this melting starts in the 20s, and I say often, I say it starts 150 years earlier. Mm-hmm. You can't blame that on people. So the idea that something's been going on for 250 years, it really hasn't changed much, but the first 200 years are natural, the next 50 are human. That seems to me a very odd way of doing science.
That's not science. Through land use, humans have, you know, impacted the climate for some centuries, deforestation and things like that, and urbanization. I mean, that's a significant impact, at least on local climates, especially in the Northern Hemisphere. So, you know, humans do impact the climate, you know, through land use change and through changing atmospheric composition, but not to be like a dominant driver, you know, that exceeds the magnitude, you know, of natural climate cycles. I mean, that just makes no sense. So, you know, we're left with, you know, this urgent mandate from the UN and many of our political leaders, you know, to stop burning fossil fuels before there's any obvious replacement. Over the course of the 21st century, I mean, it totally makes sense that we're going to transition away from fossil fuels as they become, you know, there's all sorts of issues associated with fossil fuels and, you know, look for cleaner, more abundant sources of energy. It makes total sense that we should be doing that, but putting an arbitrary timeline on it and getting rid of fossil fuels before that is in place is, you know, a sort of collective suicide, in my opinion.
Yeah, and talking about land use, of course, one of the great transformations, the enormous increase in prosperity with the Industrial Revolution in the Western world and eventually spreading to other places. And one of the things that happened is as the West urbanized and more horses were doing more and more work and more forests were cut down to grow hay. And then the cities were experiencing a considerable crisis because horses, they poop a lot, they excrete, and they also die in large numbers. And you were getting a combined problem of this urban pollution and of, again, this changing land use. And then the internal combustion engine was invented and suddenly the deforestation went into reverse and you got rid of all the manure, which was, I mean, one of the department stores when they began to be created put the perfume counter at the front for several reasons, one mm-hmm. of which was to protect the people in the store from the stench on the street. And all of that happened because fossil fuels were much better than hay for getting work done. And so it stands to reason that, yes, ingenuity, technology's moving, lots and lots of things are going to change. And one day we'll be amazed that we used to tolerate diesel engines belching fumes out of trucks. This old Boxcar Willie song about being a truck driver, and he's saying there's flames from the stack and the smoke is black as coal. And that was a boast. And one day we'll be like, what? Good grief. But the idea that the government knows what we should be doing, there's no time in history when anything like that ever happened. So it's a strange kind of economics as well as of science to say, you know, people who've never run a corner store, many political leaders are very, very innocent of private sector experience, are actually able to tell you, you should change your furnace, you should change how you cook, you should change how you drive. We know this will work. How, again, you speak about uncertainty. How do they think they know all this?
Oh, they don't know all it. They have a political agenda. And this is about their agenda, personal, you know, it's about power, it's about careerism, you know, there's all sorts of motives in play. But I mean, none of that is doing, you know, society any good, and it's doing much harm.
Yeah, and I think that, in fact, there's more and more awareness of this, that the kind of message that you've put in your book is going to get a better reception. Well, of course, we have people saying to us, oh, you know, we love your videos and has the Prime Minister seen them? And I always say, well, if so, we've yet to get the thank you note. But I don't know if political leaders do come to you on any regular basis, but if one did, And they said to you, look, I really do think we have a problem. And I you're not going to talk me out of that. But how would you have me try and approach it so that we get maximum gain for minimum pain? What three or four things would you really want to convey to the politicians, the advisors, the senior public servants, the kinds of people who are driving policy in what currently looks like a very, very unattractive direction?
Well, I mean, you know, it's hard to come up with an elevator speech on this one because it's so complex. The first one is I would give them a copy of my book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk.
Which everyone should buy, of course.
And then the second I would talk about is that you need to decouple energy policy from weather and climate policy. You have three different problems. The first one is a slow creep of climate change, which is, you know, the slow creep of sea level rise, something like that, warming. The second one is related to extreme weather events, and this is a resilience and vulnerability issue. We've always had extreme weather events. We're having them now. We're going to have them in the future. We need to figure out how to reduce our vulnerability to our water supplies and our infrastructure. And then the third pillar is energy policy. You need to decouple energy policy from the weather and climate issue, apart from trying to make your energy infrastructure resilient to weather extremes. That's a big issue. You know, we should be working on a 21st century vision for energy with, you know, abundance, increased abundance being, you know, the primary factor, cost being the secondary factor. We want to minimize land use. And then we want to make it cleaner where we can. So once you separate extreme weather from the slow creep of climate change and energy policy, you can make good progress on all three of these. However, if you regard energy and extreme weather as sitting under this big fossil fuel climate change umbrella, you're not going to solve anything. You just stand to make everything worse. So I guess that would be my elevator speech in terms of how you need to reframe the problem, cut it into smaller pieces, and then start working on some solutions.
Yeah, my academic specialty, and I must say that my academic career was dramatically less successful than yours, but my initial field of study within history was ideology. And one of the things that I'm struck by over and over again is the divide between people who think that all good things come together and the people who think that there are trade-offs involved here. And for instance, one of the things that we've said a number of times on our blog and in our videos is if climate change is a really big problem, an overwhelming existential problem, and if stopping it requires us to make huge lifestyle sacrifices, then you should tell us that you think so and that here are the sacrifices and we've got to make them anyway. Other people say, no, you don't understand. It's all going to work better. Ed Miliband, who's back in the British cabinet, as I think it's Energy and Climate Change Secretary, a strange title, did a little video where he said, back in 2008, when I was young and foolish, I thought there was a trilemma between affordability and reliability and sustainability. But now that I'm older and wiser, I see that they all come together. We must make the energy transition. And I thought to myself, that's, you're going in the wrong direction. Because in fact, yes, there are these trade-offs. If you want some good things, you have to give up other things. And if you want to get rid of fossil fuels, you're giving up affordability and reliability, and you're imposing a lot of pain. But you look at the models, they don't show gain. I think somebody calculated if you met all the Paris targets, everybody met them, the temperature in 2100 would be 1/10 of a degree lower. Well, how much would you pay for that out of your pocket?
Pretty much anything. At least people in the U.S., they complain about a few cents increase in gasoline price, you know, so they don't want to pay anything for it. But the problem is these urgent deadlines that are put on. If you would forget the UN, there would be a transition to cleaner energy that would happen naturally. I mean, there's tremendous technology advances in solar and battery storage and nuclear power and geothermal energy. I mean, these may have been spurred along a little bit by government investment because they're worried about climate change, but I think the private sector would have been on this in any event. So all of this is going to happen. The problem is with the urgent deadlines, people will say, oh, well, it's so urgent, we don't have time for new technologies, yet let's just use wind power and existing solar technologies and, you know, run with it. And that's causing a lot of problems to the electric grid. There's no way that, you know, you can get anywhere close to 80 or 90% of your energy just from wind and solar, even with battery backup. There's asynchronicity in the grid and all sorts of problems that this introduces into the grid. So while I'm a fan of rooftop solar, and even, you know, the small rooftop wind turbines that are being developed, I mean, trying to look at transcontinental grids so we can send, you know, solar power from Africa northward to Europe, and, you know, this makes absolutely no sense. So if we, you know, to me, the generation four nuclear power technologies are extremely exciting, as are advanced geothermal technologies and battery technologies. I think if you just would stop with the wind farms and the big solar farms, I think, you know, investing everything in that, we could probably make pretty decent progress, you know, over the next 50 years. On having much more abundant and cheaper energy, clean also, than we would if we keep following this path with wind and solar only with these transcontinental transmission lines. That makes no sense to me.
Yeah, we have also fairly often described support for nuclear energy as a bit of a sanity test for climate alarmists. And I've told the story in a couple of places, including our new video on corals, that I actually grew up, spent my summers at this remote cottage on the shores of Georgian Bay, which didn't have, there's no road, there's no electricity. We didn't have hot running water. The indoor toilet gave up around my ninth birthday. And we just, and to me, when I look at these, the incredible huge footprint, these wind farms, these solar panels, just destroying the countryside. I mean, even in Canada, where we've got a fair bit of room to do this, but in a place like Britain, you know, the dark satanic windmills, it, to me, it's horrifying that people who claim to be environmentalists would disregard how bad these things are for the environment, especially if they're not delivering the goods. It's amazing to force this and not let, I mean, not nature, but the natural dynamics of the market take its course and find better ways to do things.
Yeah, this is like environmentalism has been turned upside down. If you're old enough, you may remember back in the 1970s when Greenpeace was just getting started, you know, the big issue that launched them was save the whales. And now off the, you know, the East Coast of the U.S., they're putting in wind turbines and it's just mass slaughter on the whales. And, you know, Greenpeace is mum because this is supposed to be a climate change solution. So it's really, I mean, traditional environmentalism, which I subscribe to, really, has left the room. And everything is, you know, this whole climate change existential threat, which has not only is damaging economies and our resilience, it's also damaging ecosystems. So, I mean, it just makes absolutely no sense at all.
Yeah, I've had the opportunity to do a couple of conferences with Patrick Moore, who's one of the co-founders of Greenpeace. And some people have said, oh, no, he was nothing of the sort, but somebody archived the webpage where they call him that. And he's apoplectic about that issue with the whales. You know, Patrick's the guy in that iconic seal hugging photo. And, you know, he's one of these people, he hasn't really changed. And one of the reasons he says he left Greenpeace is that they simply stopped believing in science, which to him was a betrayal of the need, if you care about the environment, to do good things about the environment. And one interesting example where I think we may see progress from the private sector, these AI, these high tech firms who tend to be, you know, big on climate change as well, but their servers and their farms and all the stuff they do is so energy hungry, is that they're getting very interested in these micro nuclear plants that they want to have one right at their data center, not have this intercontinental or transcontinental grid, not have this huge footprint, but just get the power generated using modern, clean, efficient methods right where it's needed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. No, there, I'm a techno optimist. You know, I think if we just, you know, let everybody, if we don't restrict them, you know, and cut off their electric power and overregulate them and censor them and whatever, you know, I think I have great faith, you know, in human ingenuity and the tech companies to really make great progress in the 21st century. But, you know, we're putting, you know, one hand behind their back with all the regulations and everything else. So, you know, we're doing a lot of stupid things right now.
Yeah, I think I'm probably a bit less of a techno-optimist, partly on the grounds, not that it won't work, but that if money could buy happiness, it would have by now. On the other hand, making people artificially poor certainly buys misery. And so I think the one of the major lessons of history, including, you look at the medieval revolution where windmills and water mills really were cutting edge, and they spread naturally. There was no government mandate, and they relieved both people and animals of a lot of the worst backbreaking labor, grinding corn in a water mill or a windmill versus doing it with a treadmill. Goodness gracious, that was so there are, and again, lots of little and unexpected things can happen. Some of the world's great technological breakthroughs happen because of the free play of circumstance and coincidence, as well as that of human ingenuity. Now, I want to change tacks here because there's another and more abstract question, but one that I think ought to get asked a great deal more when people say, oh, no, the Earth is too hot, and if it gets any hotter, there will be this terrible breakdown of natural systems. The question, what is the right temperature for the Earth, and how do you know? It seems to me that these two linked questions ought to be much more prominent in the debate than they are, because if people are going to admit, well, I don't know how warm the Earth should be, then they're going to have to back off on a lot of this stuff about another 0.2 of a degree is the end.
Well, I deal with this issue in chapter one of my book, you know, when I called the Goldilocks dilemma. You know, if you're familiar with the story of the Goldilocks and the three bears, you know, this one is too hot.
I'm old enough to be, yes.
Just right. Okay, so what is just right? And so the IPCC and the UN have implicitly assumed that pre-industrial was just right. Well, this was toward the end, you know, the 18th and early 19th century. This was at the end of the Little Ice Age, the coldest period of the last millennium. North America was horribly, horribly cold. You know, in the U.S., the winters that George Washington suffered through in Valley Forge were legendary, you know, in terms of their extreme cold. I mean, who wants to go back to that? And also in the U.S., people are migrating from northern states, you know, from Illinois and New York, and they're going to Florida and Texas and Arizona, where it's much warmer. They don't like cold winters. So, you know, why do people think, you know, that a degree or so is warmer is going to be worse? In Canada and Siberia and northern China, I would imagine that warmth is overall beneficial. In terms of agriculture, in terms of just, you know, humans working outside in the winter and otherwise being outside in the winter. So there's no prima facie reason to think that warm is much worse than cold. And, you know, and in terms of the planet, you know, the planet would totally be fine with a few degrees warmer temperature. And in fact, you know, 8,000 years ago, the planet was significantly warmer, and certainly throughout geologic history, there have been periods that were much warmer than we are now. So the planet would be just fine. I mean, it's all about humans and what they prefer. People, you know, we're sort of adapted to our current climate. So, you know, any deviations, but natural variability, climate variability already provides substantial deviations, both in temperature and extreme weather events. So, you know, saying that a degree or 2 degrees warmer is going to be a much worse situation, it's not very well justified. Again, apart from the slow creep of sea level rise, which has been going on since the end of the Little Ice Age, and it will keep going for another century or two, probably. So I think that's the weakest part of the whole argument, whether warming is dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up Canada as an example, and, you know, Canada's famous for its wilderness, which we all think we love, although an increasing number of us have never seen it. But if you look where people live in Canada, they're all stapled to the southern border because it's just so cold everywhere else. And, you know, our farmers, if the growing season got 2 weeks shorter, Canada's prodigious agricultural output would be in a heap of trouble. And it's also interesting because you mentioned the Holocene climatic optimum, which I've always thought was an interesting name. And again, recently I had somebody on one of our discussion things saying, oh, how do you know it was warmer then? Because they kind of have to get rid of that. And one of the reasons they have to get rid of it is that if the Holocene climatic optimum was warmer than today, but you did not see this runaway greenhouse effect, you did not see mass extinctions, you didn't see the coral dying, you didn't see the polar bears dying, you didn't see all the predictions that we're getting if it gets to be 2 degrees warmer than pre-industrial. And again, I hate that term because everything is pre-industrial until James Watt. You know, the Neogene is pre-industrial, the Cretaceous is pre-industrial. But although there's much uncertainty, we do know the Holocene climatic optimum was warmer than today, right? That's one of those things that it's a bit daft to dispute.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, sea level rise, there's really good sedimentary evidence that sea level rise was several meters higher in many locations, you know, in the mid-Holocene. So you don't have to look all that far back to find significantly warmer climate.
Yeah, and obviously we don't want that stuff coming back in a big hurry, but sooner or later. Now, I want to come back at this point again to this this thing that you wrote in 2010 about on the credibility of climate change toward rebuilding trust. And at the end of it, you said two things, and one of them is, in a way, it's a bit quaint now because you were talking about the blogospheric experiment, and that's back when journalists would write about somebody's blog and then explain that it was a weblog. Will it demonstrate how the diversity of blogs can help? And I think in the whole, it's demonstrated that, yes, they can, but it's also a field in which the cloven hoof reveals itself and people can be belligerent idiots. So it's a mixed bag. But the other thing you said, no one really believes that the science is settled or that the debate is over. Scientists and others that say this seem to want to advance a particular agenda. There is nothing more detrimental to public trust than such statements. And we are now very nearly 15 years away past you making that statement. How are we doing on rebuilding public trust in science, and what should we be doing? Because it's important that we should be able to trust the experts and they should deserve it. What should we be doing to get back to a better, more solid, more civil, and more productive scientific discussion among the public as well as among the specialists?
Okay, well, trust in science took a big hit over the COVID issue. And, you know, that was almost a bigger hit than the climate change issue. So public trust in science is really at quite a low, I would say. And, you know, I guess scientists have to be open, you know, the same things that I read, you know, they have to be transparent, honest and open, discuss uncertainties and engage with the public. I mean, that's what we have to keep doing. And the strategy of the alarmist, you know, of attacking their opponents and dismissing them as deniers and disinformers and whatever, I mean, to me, that diminishes trust in science like all get out. So a lot of this is to blame. A lot of this blame goes to the activist climate scientists. I mean, Michael Mann being the foremost example, but there are many of them out there. To me, they have destroyed trust in the public about climate science.
Yeah, and we, of course, we don't want to get drawn off too far afield. And one thing, by the way, the Climate Discussion Nexus, we are militantly against conspiracy theories. And I spend a lot of time telling people, please don't go down the rabbit hole. We need you up here in the sunlight using your brain. But when it comes to COVID, there are, I think, two things that really are very important. One is this refusal to debate the lab leak and the problem that it's becoming increasingly clear that it was not zoonotic origin. And the other one is exaggerating the effectiveness of the vaccines and the certainty that the government's measures were right. And the problem is that we can't not examine these things. We're an open society. We have to do this. But if we find out that on two critical points, the establishment threw all its weight behind something, not just something that was wrong, but something that they didn't have sufficient warrant to believe, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. But the same is true of climate. If it turns out that the whole humans are wrecking the climate, just making the weather terrible, overheating the earth, if it turns out that this was badly exaggerated, that's going to diminish trust unless we can start walking it back, the sooner the better, recovering our civility, our humility, and our sense that science is a project that everybody has a right to be part of, but everybody better be careful about the error bars.
Well, the COVID people are better at walking things back than the climate people. So I think that hopefully the COVID issue and the public health issue surrounding that will turn around in the coming years. The climate issue, politicians and scientists have made their whole careers around this issue, and their political power, their public exposure, their big lecture fees, their big book sales, all of this is tied up in climate alarmism. So, it's hard for them to let go. You say, well, aren't scientists supposed to be above some of that? Well, they're supposed to be, but they're human also. But, all we can do is, I think podcasts like what you're doing, is a big help. And, again, I'm pretty active on Twitter trying to publicize, good studies and good ideas and good analyses that I find worthwhile. So, it's hard to overturn this one. This climate thing has so much political power behind it. It's a tough nut to crack.
Yeah, it is a tough one. I was recently rereading Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. This is a curious thing that I read a lot of good books when I was at university, but almost none of them were assigned in courses. This one was, and it got me started on this whole vexing problem, the fact that even once you get rid of the fools and the knaves, there's legitimate room for disagreement on important issues, and yet you can't just surrender on the look for truth. And one of the things Kuhn said is that scientific fields often change not so much because established practitioners change their minds, but because new people coming into the field bring different ideas. And so you have this kind of climate establishment. But one of the things that worries me is that the Michael Manns of this world have so taken over the public universities and the journals and so on, that it's almost impossible for these younger people with different views to get started in the field now. Even if some of the established alarmists said, maybe we better open the field to new views, who would supervise their doctorates?
Yeah. No, this is exactly right. Ironically, the so-called skeptical community, they're mostly people who are their 60s, 70s, and 80s, people who are mostly outside of the academic ecosystem at this point. Anybody who's skeptical of climate change and they're younger, they don't even bother with academia. They're going to the private sector or to, think tank NGO type organizations. They're not in academia. So, the new generation of climate scientists are actually motivated to want to follow the example of Michael Mann. And a lot of them are taking soft core curricula, not the hardcore physics-based science that I was educated on, but climate studies, which is very soft core. So, this is a big problem. We've lost at least a whole generation of climate dynamicists, people, with a serious understanding of how the climate system works, who should be at the forefront of figuring all this out. But instead, you know, we're educating this whole cadre of climate journalists and activists, scientists, rather than people who actually understand anything and can do frontier research in this area. Not a good situation.
Yeah, I mean, I try not to be too snide about this, but because you get this meme about not a climate scientist, I often will comment when somebody has made some dogmatic statement in the press of what their degree is in. And I remember at one point, there was a news story with two co-authors that said that Will Happer was not formally trained as a climate scientist. As, you know, Will Happer is a distinguished atmospheric physicist. And when you think about this supposed fundamental piece of the whole man-made global warming, where our CO2 absorbs radiation and then scatters it, it's hard to think of anything that's more directly related to atmospheric physics than that. And then I look at their credentials, and it was, you know, a degree in English or in Latin American studies or something. And I thought, okay, how much math went into that? Of course, I get criticized. People say, well, you're a historian. And my answer is, well, historians look at the past to try and predict the future. And that's kind of what everybody does, including scientists who go into a lab and do an experiment again and again and say, every time in the past this happened, so in the future this will happen. But at the same time, and a slightly more hopeful thing is that among the young people going into science, there's still, I think, a lot of belief in the things you were talking about the open discussion of data and exchange of ideas and civility toward colleagues. And I hope that many of them are feeling as though there's something wrong with the environment in which they're working. But on the downside, I remember Eisenhower with his famous military industrial complex warning, but he also warned against government capture of science. He said more and more science is government funded, and this will tend to politicize it. So there's two things here pulling in opposite directions.
Well, frankly, I think things are much more honest in the private sector where you don't, you know, and it's a totally different environment. Apart from being much more faster paced, if you're doing something that really doesn't make sense, you'll lose money and you'll lose clients, you know, and the feedback on that, you know, is on a time scale of a year or two. So you can't do fundamentally stupid things or things that turn out to be wrong or things that are misleading or things that are unjustified. The private sector, you know, is much more stringent in terms of how it judges and assesses, you know, this kind of thing. So to me, it's a much better environment. Academia and with government funding and stuff like that, that's just all a big mess. And I don't know how to fix it. You know, I left all that knowing that, you know, I could beat my head against the wall and try to change things, but I wasn't going to get anywhere. So I just left, you know, I shrugged, I left. But yeah, no, it's a big problem. I mean, there needs to be a political sea change before all this gets turned around.
Yes, I remember years ago someone saying the invisible hand of the marketplace is accompanied by the visible foot, where if you're bad at it, you get kicked out. And of course, it's a good moment to remind people that you run the Climate Forecast Applications Network, which does rely upon getting things right in order to attract clients. And people, of course, go and check all that out. And again, I remember my father's passed away now. He's an English professor. And he said to me, you know, when I was a young man, most universities were private. And he said, nowadays, people seem unable to imagine a private university. It's different in the United States. One of the hopeful things is that most American colleges and universities are still private. But it seems to me that one of the things we really ought to do is privatize the universities, to say, if you go to university, you gain so much from that degree. You earn more, you have higher social standing, you talk loudly at parties. It makes sense for the government to pay for the primary and secondary, but post-secondary, get it out of the clutches of the government. So it's a multifaceted problem. And again, as I think you were touching on, the political culture, and I'm not saying politics in the role Roman Republic was exactly elevated, but the political culture is very nasty these days, and it's there's a kind of a nastiness. And one thing we do at the Climate Discussion Nexus, by the way, is that we don't allow cuss words in comments, we don't allow personal attacks, I keep having to tell people abuse is not argument, and that goes both ways. I don't care which side you're on. So one of the things, and again, you on Twitter, I know Twitter can be a real sewer, but your tweets are not of that quality. They have a high degree of civility as well as intelligence. So part of it, again, is that we all just have to, as usual, try to do our own part to conduct this discussion in such a way that it gets better and not worse.
Oh, I mean, it's a huge challenge. I mean, this whole, you know, I think this whole hyper-partisanship started in about 2015, at least in the U.S. It just became so polarized. And, you know, it's a very bad situation on a lot of fronts. But when you start polarizing the science, scientific research, then it's a very bad place. And by oversimplifying things and with these politicized science, you end up giving bad advice to policymakers, which leads to bad decisions, which puts everyone in a bad place.
We get people all the time who come and comment on the videos who charge in and say, well, you deniers like to hide facts and so on. And I think to myself, unless you're here to be purely destructive, shouldn't you start out with, I watched your video and I was puzzled by this assertion. It seems to me that the evidence points the other way. And sometimes I think it's just young people have not ever seen manners and so they have trouble exhibiting them. But because there's an almost willful attempt not to engage on places where you might get somewhere. And
disagreement and debate used to be the spice of academic life and public discourse. You know, now it's all about dogma and consensus enforcement and attacking anyone who disagrees with you. A very bad place. And you don't have to go back too long, even maybe two decades. I mean, all this has just really happened in about the last 10 years when it's become just so awful and intolerant and stupid, if you will.
Well, yeah, it's almost as though, you know, there was a tipping point that things were gradually deteriorating. And I remember I taught university for a couple of years, and my first year was at what was thought to be a pretty conservative university. And I said to the chairman that I would like to stay on. And he said, oh, no, you know, if I'd known you were conservative, I wouldn't have hired you. And I said, gee, that's kind of an odd thing for you to say. And he said, oh, it's just that we don't like ideology. And I said, sir, we're sitting in your office under a big 6 by 6 foot red flag of Che Guevara. And he said, that's just office decoration. And I ended up in the private sector. And and I think I've been happier for it. I do miss the classroom. But I think, yeah, it's just gotten worse and worse. And again, there's sort of a plea here for everybody. And this, again, this includes those of you who are watching and are skeptical of climate orthodoxy. Let's be ruthless with arguments, but gentle with disputants. We're trying to get people to change their minds. And I think it was Dale Carnegie somewhere, he'd said, you know, when you start out, you're an idiot because you rarely make a convert of the person that you're talking to. So we're almost done here. I know you have a hard stop speaking of the private sector because you've got a hurricane to watch. Do you have any last thoughts before we wrap up?
Not really. I hope you will take a look at my book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk. I think it provides a blueprint for much broader and sensible thinking about the problem and its solutions. And I'd be interested in your feedback. I assume my contact information will be posted somewhere along where you can email me or follow me on Twitter and we can continue the dialogue.
Yes, we will. We will certainly post all that. And again, I think that the book is a model not only in terms of its intellectual content, but also the tone that makes for constructive debate that has also been very much true of our discussion here today. And again, I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to come and talk to us about it and to try to get us forward in every dimension of this multifaceted problem, including, of course, understanding the inherent complexity of it, because it's a huge component of the problem. Like, it's not the dogmatists are saying this is happening and we're saying that's happening. It's a matter of, in large measure, of saying, well, we're not really sure what's happening. And therefore, as your book says, let us be very careful to be ready for the unexpected, because that is, again, from the history, one of the lessons of history is you better expect the unexpected. Nobody really knows what's going to happen. Even when Martin Luther nailed up his theses, he did not see the Protestant Reformation coming. And remember Adam Ulam, Soviet specialist, and when Khrushchev was deposed and people said, hey, if you know so much, why didn't you see it coming? And he said, well, Khrushchev didn't see it coming. So again, Dr. Judith Curry, thank you so much for joining us. And everybody should indeed check out her book. That's Climate Uncertainty and Risk, Rethinking Our Response. We'll have the rest up on the screen when this video is uploaded, as it will be shortly. Thank you to everybody who's watching, and let us all persist with civility and intelligence so we can get it right, or at least less wrong. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed talking with you.